Rudolf von Linnaeus, bad reproduction. As there are serious doubts about the authenticity of the story given by Jarl, I decided to do some research on Rudolf von Linnaeus. A search on the internet revealed surprisingly few details. He is the author of Solens Rike, a book about the spiritual message in Chinese art, published in Sweden 1939. According to bibliographical information in the Swedish catalogue Libri, this is a translation from German, Das Reich der Sonne, but I have found no data on this book. My copy of the Swedish edition is autographed by Linnaeus and translated in Swedish by Mrs. Elspeth Funch, author and globetrotter. During Linnaeus' visit to Sweden in 1939, he visited the home of Mrs. Funch to study her collections of Chinese art. An internet search reveals that Linnaeus wrote a short manuscript included in My Life in Germany before and after January 30, 1933. This manuscript is preserved at the manuscript collection at Houghton Library, Harvard University. These biographical data are presented. Linnaeus, Rudolf von, 33, B, Triest, Catholic, divorced, architect, last German residence, Berlin, 1940. Distbygger, Sweden. A widely traveled architect, the author expresses his astonishment and disgust towards the Nazi movement after returning to Germany in 1934-1935. In a loosely structured, impressionistic manuscript entitled Inquisition Berlin Alexanderplatz, he describes the process of Nazi takeover and how people around him make their peace with the new regime. Most of the manuscript is taken up with his description of his sudden arrest and incarceration in a concentration camp. 48 pp. Typescript. In Ancestry, I found that Rudolf von Linnaeus moved to California in 1956 and changed his name to Roy Rulin. But this is all I have been able to find on the internet, so I wrote to several of the largest archives and libraries in Germany, Austria, including Triest, but very few of these institutions found any data on Linnaeus, which is quite surprising as they searched in databases, reference, and biographical books. I did receive some new data though from Bibliotheca Civica Attilio Hortius in Triest. Rudolf von Linnaeus was born in Triest, November 2, 1907, and was the illegitimate son of Gaisipina von Linnaeus, daughter of Teresa, who lived in Triest in Via G. Gotzi 3. Rudolf was baptized in the month of January, 1908, in the church of St. Antonio Tormatago. But the most interesting information regarding Linnaeus' experiences in Tibet was found in an article he wrote for the Swedish daily Stockholms, Tidningen, September 17, 1939. I ordered a copy of this article from the National Library of Sweden. It was printed in the Sunday supplement and well illustrated. This article is probably a written version of his lecture at the International Club in Stockholm. Here is a very short summary of his Tibetan adventure. During his travels in Tibet, he met two monks who brought him to a remote monastery where are preserved secret and sacred scripts engraved on blue metal, half a million years old, and also metals and instruments unknown to man. Linnaeus claims to have brought a piece of one metal to a laboratory in England and they could not identify it. He also witnessed a large gong 13 meters in diameter. For several hundred years, this monastery has only been visited by 8 foreigners. The monks are preparing a mission to present the ancient wisdom to the world. A philosophy, religion, without fanaticism, hierarchy and ignorance. During his stay, Linnaeus is allowed to follow the monks to another monastery where he spends 9 months of study. It is at this place he becomes a witness to the lifting of heavy stones with the help of sound. One day, monks are stationed around the monastery to keep all strangers away. Large metal shields are placed in a certain geometrical position together with a gong of 3 meters in diameter, made of 3 different metals. Monks are nude with only shields of metal on their bodies. They strike the gong, which gives a thunderous sound. The monks can now carry large blocks or stone as if they were made of paper and build the new structure very easily. Linnaeus tries this himself and is surprised to be able to lift a massive stone without effort. After about 3 hours, 200 stones have been set in place. Lina gets a headache and palpitation of the sound, and some of the monks must be carried to rest because of the deep concentration involved in the work. This is what I have been able to document regarding the fascinating experiences of Rudolf von Lina. Whether his story is true or fiction is an open question. Hopefully more data can be discovered by others involved in similar types of research. New data on Rudolf von Lina. Reality is often stranger than fiction. I was made aware of this old proverb after publishing my blog entry on the enigmatic and fascinating Rudolf von Lina this summer. With the help of some friends, I traced one of Lina's daughters, Christina, living in Stockholm. She has kindly lent me photographs, drawings and other documents relating to her father. I first called her on the phone, August 30th, and we have been in constant contact since then. Half an hour after my first talk with Christina, an email dropped into my mailbox. It was from a lady, Monica, in Florida. She had discovered my blog entry on Lina and was very glad for the information because she also was one of Rudolf von Lina's daughters. Monica had for years been trying to find data on her father. I must admit this was like a perfect synchronicity, a la Carl Gustav Jung. For some weeks now, Christina, Monica and I have been exchanging data on their father, and the much new information has come to light. I will try to present a brief summary of all the new data. Rudolf von Lina was married in Stockholm 1939. His wife Abba gave birth to a daughter, Christina, in August 1940. Rudolf moved to California in 1947 and the marriage ended in divorce 1948. Christina was only 7 years when her father left and has not so many memories of him. Her mother Abba died in 2007. She related to Christina about Rudolf's experiences in Tibet, but she was skeptical of his tales. An article and interview with the Lina family was published in the Swedish magazine Idun 1941 with photos of their home in Stockholm. Of the Idun article. In the Idun article, Rudolf von Lina is presented as film architect, and he relates spending 3 years in China doing historical documentaries for Metro-Goldwyn. Much of the article is a presentation of the unusual Chinese flower decorations and furnishings in the apartment crafted by Rudolf. The Chinese love of flowers helps him to forget himself, and it has helped me on several occasions. He prefers China because of its culture but regards America as the land of possibilities. Rudolf left a home in Berlin because of the war, and he appreciates that Sweden has given him a refuge. Christina has lent me some drawings made by his father. He was obviously a very talented artist. Monica was also born in Stockholm in 1940, and she had heard rumors of a half-sister but was never able to locate her. Monica was the result of Rudolf's secret love affair with another woman, Hildegard, living in Stockholm. Because of my blog, Christina and Monica are very glad to have finally made contact. Monica has several old letters from her mother where she tells of Rudolf's travels in Tibet. She also talked to and has several letters from her father. In America, he changed his name to Roy Rulin and married a woman named Madeline in 1952. They had two daughters. Rudolf von Lina died in Los Angeles 1966. Because of all the new data, I am now trying to find documentation verifying the Tibetan travels. Hopefully some of the clues will yield result. Another fascinating coincidence is that Monica had a close encounter with a UFO in 1959 or 1960. The UFO experience I had was when I was in college 1960 or thereabout. I was driving from my mother's house in Connecticut back to my college in Massachusetts on a stretch of road, highway that had two lanes and was deserted of other cars at 1 o'clock in the morning as it was. All of a sudden, on my right and out of the passenger side window, I could see on the open field an enormous amount of light. So enormous. It was blinding. A lot of light and flashes of light were coming from below, as well from all around whatever it was. I immediately pulled the car over and stopped on the side of the road, right by it. I opened my door and stood there in amazement. I walked around the car to the side of the road so as to be standing right in front of it. I was looking at an oval, flat but not completely flat, big object. The light was all around the right side and around the left side. Also light radiating from it toward the back and light underneath. It was now sitting on legs, not tall legs, more medium to short leg length, so the light, bright before, was not as bright as it was when it was coming down onto the field by the highway. I stood there and IT stood there. We stood together for some time. I have no idea how long. But I just stared. Now when I think back I remember shadows inside. But no one nor anything ever came out. IT stood there and I stood there and I was absolutely fascinated and fearless. After a time it lifted off right in front of me and away it went. It left me standing there and did not leave in a hurry or with a thrust into the sky. It gently took off on a bit of an angle. As it left, the angle became more of an angle and up. I returned to the car and all I can say is that it was one of those experiences that I instinctively knew I could not tell anyone, no one would believe me. I was amazed and deep in a thoughtful cloud of closeness to whatever this was, for years. I never once doubted what I saw, how long we stood there together, where it was and how it all looked. The distance to the object was not more than 30, 40 feet, according to Monica. As for dreams or a psychic experience, I do not think so. I'm a pretty realistic type person. Speaking of Jung and synchronicity, the Evans Library is now getting more and more in order. Last week every book in our classification system P, Paranormal Phenomena, Parapsychology, Occultism, Theosophy, Spiritualism, had been catalogued by the AFU team Katarina, Ingrid and Anders. As for Jung and Freud, we have all their collected writings. My of the project has been decorating the Evans Library with various illustrations and photos. Tobias Lindgren, head of UFO, Sweden's reporting central, is living right above the library and he often drops in for a chat. Rudolf von Linnaeus and Tibet. Since my latest blog entry on Rudolf von Linnaeus and the mystery of his Tibetan journey in the 1930s, some new information have appeared. I still have not found the smoking gun, definite evidence that he visited Tibet, but various types of circumstantial evidence indicating travels in Asia and a wide knowledge of Chinese culture. After many contacts and exchange of data with Rudolf von Linnaeus's daughters, Christina in Stockholm and Monica in Florida, some more pieces to this intricate puzzle can now be added. The ultimate question is, of course, whether there is any truth to Rudolf von Linnaeus's claim of visiting a secret Tibetan monastery and witnessing a group of lamas lifting heavy stones with the help of sound waves. He told this experience in an article in the Swedish daily Stockholms Tidningen, September 17, 1939, and also during a lecture at Internationella Klubben, the International Club, in Stockholm sometime in the autumn of 1939. The archive of Internationella Klubben is preserved at the Stockholm City Archives, but so far they have not answered my request for information regarding the Linnaeus lecture in 1939. Rudolf von Linnaeus. In my former blog entry on Linnaeus I mentioned the article from Idun magazine. Unfortunately the issue and year was not correct. When I checked this reference there was no article and photos from the Linnaeus home in Stockholm. Instead the interview was printed in Idun number 48, 1942. In this article Rudolf mentioned his love of Chinese culture and that he spent 3 years in China. Obviously he was an expert on Chinese art, evidenced by his book Solens Reich, Das Reich der Sun, published in Sweden 1939. It is a study of classic Chinese artists and their spiritual message. Searching the internet I also found that Rudolf von Linnaeus was advisor to the 1937 movie Alarm in Peking. This is a clear indication that he was well informed on China and its culture and support his claim of living 3 years in that country. This is also supported by his personal biography Inquisition Berlin Alexanderplatz, preserved as manuscript at Houghton Library, Harvard University. I bought a copy of this 48 pages German manuscript which arrived from Harvard University recently. It has this short presentation: a widely traveled architect, the author expresses his astonishment and disgust towards the Nazi movement after returning to Germany in 1934, 1935. In a loosely structured, Impressionistic manuscript entitled Inquisition Berlin Alexanderplatz, he describes the process of Nazi takeover and how people around him make their peace with the new regime. Most of the manuscript is taken up with his description of his sudden arrest and incarceration in a concentration camp. I believed this manuscript only covered Rudolf's years in Germany, but it also has a short biography of his life and travels around the world. The manuscript is now being translated from German to Swedish by my old friend Hans Abrahamsson. Here are a few relevant quotes. The original beautiful poetic quality of his writing is unfortunately lost in translation. All the following years were filled with lots of work, living, experiencing, witnessing and searching, wandering and waiting. Many metropolis offered me work and presented enigmas. Many necropolis was even bigger enigmas. Jujuy, the old Aztec city on the slopes of Cordilleran, Chainig. The priest city of the buried alive in Himalaya, Takhanyo. The underground kingdom of eternal fire at the foot of Quin, Lund. Behind me was 1.5 years of work in Peking. Behind me was 9 months travel and residence in Tibet. Weeks of travel on waddling camels, on calm and sluggish oxen and on foot over stone and sand deserts. A month stay at the Dugpa monks monastery, embedded in a deep valley. In this monastery with documents and artifacts from epochs no European ever heard of. According to a second interview in Stockholm's Tidningen, Rudolf von Linnau could enter Tibet because of help from his Chinese friends who were members of a secret society. He was allowed to visit a secret monastery unknown even to many Tibetans. Of these monks, he says in the interview, a usual opinion is that these monks must know very little of what is happening in Europe, but that is not the case. On the contrary, they have detailed knowledge on what is happening and are in constant contact with a secret society in Scotland. Two of the white men who visited the Imre of Tibet before me were Scottish. Whether it will be possible to find any more details on this mystery is an open question. There are a few more clues to follow up. In the literature of the esoteric tradition, there are many references to a now forgotten knowledge of lifting heavy stones with the help of sound. A knowledge preserved by the custodians of the ancient wisdom, maybe one of the secret societies referred to by Rudolf von Linnau. Alice Bailey, amanuensis for the Tibetan, writes in Letters on Occult Meditation, the laws that govern the erection of large buildings and the handling of great weights will someday be understood in terms of sound. The cycle returns, and in the days to come will be seen the reappearance of the faculty of the Lemurians and early Atlanteans to raise great masses, this time on a higher turn of the spiral. Mental comprehension of the method will be developed. They were raised through the ability of the early builders to create a vacuum through sound, and to utilize it for their own purposes. p. 249-250. Whatever the truth of these assertions, we can still enjoy the mystery of the Rudolf von Linnau story and his artistic talents. I found many of his illustrations in the Swedish novel Misstänkt, Suspected, published in 1947. Theodor Illion as esotericist. In 3 earlier blog entries, I have presented the fascinating life and mystery surrounding Drive Rudolf von Linnau, who claimed to have witnessed Tibetan monks lifting giant blocks of stone using sound waves from various instruments. These blog entries gave the unexpected result that I was contacted by 2 of Dr. Linnau's daughters, Monica in Florida and Christina in Sweden. They had never met before, and because of my blog there was a happy family reunion. I am very glad to have been the cause of this reunion, and we all had a delightful rendezvous in Norrköping, Sweden in the summer of 2014. Dr. Rudolf von Linnau. Dr. Rudolf von Linnau is not the only person claiming extraordinary experiences in Tibet in the 1930s. For many years I have been very intrigued by 2 books written by the German writer Theodor Illion, 1898-1984, In Secret Tibet, 1937, Arig, Ratzelhaft's Tibet, 1936, and Darkness Over Tibet, 1937. Using the pseudonym Theodor Brung, he also wrote several books and articles on Tibetan medicine. There is some debate whether Theodore Elian ever visited Tibet, but according to old articles and interviews, he was in the 1930s physically extremely well trained and fit for such an expedition. He was also obviously endowed with an iron will and determination to reach his goals. So on these accounts he could very well have succeeded in his endeavors to explore Tibet alone on foot. In January 1933 he visited Sweden for training trips in hiking and was interviewed by the Swedish newspaper Dagens Nyheter November 3, 1933. According to the article, Theodore Elian was born in Canada, raised in Japan, educated at Paris, New York, Berlin and Istanbul. He is a writer, journalist, hiker, philosopher and vegetarian. He is walking around 5 Swedish miles a day, only living on black bread and milk. For the past 8 weeks I have hiked through Germany, studying Nazism, an interesting journey that ended close to the Danish border. I wished to see how a political refugee could get to Denmark. He is now in Stockholm, where he will lecture at several places. The Theosophical Society. Elian has some critical, philosophical remarks on today's society. They invent technical means that grows over their heads instead of for one moment thinking of their own moral development. I have checked old issues of the Swedish theosophical magazine Teosofisk Tidskrift, but there is no mention of any lecture by Elian. Article in Dagens Nyheter November 3, 1933. There is very little information available on the life of Theodore Elian. A short article on Wikipedia and almost no useful references on the internet. In his book Nazis of Tibet, a 20th century myth, author Ranan Gelhart mentioned that it may be worth noting that Gestapo ordered Elian to furnish documentary evidence of his alleged visits to Tibet when he returned to Germany in 1941, since he was under suspicion of being a liar, who claimed he had visited Tibet although he had never been there. According to the Wikipedia article, Elian was a member of the Club of Rome, never married and had no children. A few more biographical details are presented in his books, but it is somewhat surprising that there are so few data on his life, as he lectured in several countries around Europe and was often interviewed extensively in large newspapers. In the preface to his first book In Secret Tibet, Elian gives a brief presentation of himself. "I traveled in Tibet neither as a Christian nor as a Buddhist. I did not look at things merely with the eyes of the scientist or the philosopher. I tried to examine things in an absolutely unprejudiced way. I do not belong to any sect, party, or denomination. My interest in Tibet was centered around the reality of Tibetan mysteries and psychical phenomena." 18. 3 articles were published about my expedition, the Sunday Express mentioning the fact that I was looking for companions to accompany me to Central Asia. P. 26. Elian also mentioned an interview that was published in a large Stockholm paper in 1935 inches, but gives no further information. As with Dr. Rudolf von Linnaeus, there are no definite data to confirm that Theodore Elian ever visited Tibet in the 1930s. There have been some speculation that he relied on the information in the books by Alexandra David, Neil, published in the 1920s, and simply used the Tavelog about Tibet as a way to present his philosophy. Whatever the truth, the books by Theodore Elian are a treasure trove of wisdom. Anyone thoroughly acquainted with the esoteric tradition will here find a kindred soul. I do find it amazing that Elian at his young age could have such extraordinary deep insights into esoteric philosophy, coupled with a critical mind and wonderful humor. I am a non-smoker. I only smoke in the company of people who consider non-smoking a virtue. In Secret Tibet is the story of Theodore Elian's travel in disguise in Tibet, meeting hermits, lamas and the somewhat more mysterious few wise men, very different from the often primitive and superstitious hermits. He encounters and is able to study many types of psychic phenomena, some apparently genuine but often produced by the grossest type of fraud. Elian gives many practical examples and is very aware of the negative power of organized Orthodox religion in the world. Organized Buddhism, as it stands today, is a formidable machinery for exercising power by exploiting fear and credulity, especially Buddhism as it is in Tibet and Nepal. The Tibetans on the whole like to be told what to do. This prevents unnecessary thinking. The lamas greatly profit by this attitude. 116. This reminds me of a quote from the classic The Mahatma Letters to A.P. Sinnett, where the adept K.H. comments on the problem of religion in world history. The chief cause of nearly two-thirds of the evils that pursue humanity ever since that cause became a power. It is religion under whatever form and in whatsoever nation. It is the sacerdotal caste, the priesthood and the churches. It is in those illusions that man looks upon as sacred, that he has to search out the source of that multitude of evils which is the great curse of humanity and that almost overwhelms mankind. Letter number 10, 1882. The truth of this statement must be obvious to anyone following today's news. Theodore Illion's sequel Darkness Over Tibet is a real adventure story and have by many readers been regarded as too fantastic and pure fiction. Illion is led to a secret underground community and is allowed an interview with the spiritual leader of the community, who he soon realizes is a very evil man and black magician. After having fled from this group, indulging in cannibalism, Illion gives an interesting comment on the two different philosophic or spiritual schools he have encountered. In this world of matter, which is really the battleground for a formidable struggle of two different spiritualities, the few wise men of Tibet, who are great and dynamic personalities, intensely personal and yet acting impersonally, represent a kind of bodyguard of the Creator, which holds in check the other camp of methodically working annihilators and soul snatchers. 191. This, of course, is esotericism and a very good description of the planetary guardians or higher intelligence agency. Here, I highly recommend these two books by Theodore Illion to anyone with an interest in the esoteric tradition. As the author told of lecturing for the Swedish Theosophical Society, it is obvious that the ancient wisdom was his inspiration, and he appears to have been an accomplished esotericist both in theory and practice. There is also deep psychological insights and a gentle humanism in his writings. He is very well aware of the human condition on this interplanetary Alcatraz. Humaneness is the thing badly needed in this world, which dies from lack of love. We need people who are humane, really and spontaneously humane, in the little things of their daily lives. We have enough idealists who have occasional fits of idealism and tread the worm on the ground while they are looking for the stars. Desmond Leslie as esotericist. In the history of the UFO movement, Desmond Leslie, 1921-2001, has a prominent role, and it was his writings and theories that to a large extent influenced much of the 1950s and 60s ufology. The book he co-authored with the controversial contactee George Adamski, Flying Saucers Have Landed, 1953, became a bestseller and was translated into more than 30 languages. Global sales reached around 1 million. When a revised and very much enlarged edition was published by Neville Spearman in 1970, Flying Saucer Review editor Charles Bowen named it the book that was dynamite. Much has been written by and about Desmond Leslie, but it was not until 2010 that a biography appeared. Desmond Leslie. The Biography of an Irish Gentleman by journalist and art historian Robert O'Byrne. It is a traditional biography presenting Leslie's family history, marriages, career as musician, and the rather complicated and stressful life he lived beginning in 1963, when he, in spite of financial and personal problems, in the end succeeded in preserving and developing his family estate, Castle Leslie, in Glasgow, Ireland. But to me, the biography is something of disappointment. It is obvious that the author has very little knowledge of, nor sympathy for, either ufology or the esoteric tradition, which are referred to as eccentric and quasi-religious subjects. In this respect, the book becomes a flatland biography, never reaching the soul of Desmond Leslie. We still have to wait for an scholarly ufologist or esotericist to write a biography that will give the final word on Desmond Leslie and his fascinating life. In his book The 50s Spiritual Marketplace, 1997, religious scholar Robert Elwood refers to Desmond Leslie as a British esotericist. This is to a large extent a correct description. Flying Saucers Have Landed was the first major UFO book that connected flying saucers to Blavatsky's Vimanas and the esoteric tradition. There are many references and quotes from the classic works of Alice Bailey, Trevor Barker, Annie Besant, H.P. Blavatsky, Geoffrey Hodgson, C.W. Leadbeater, A.E. Powell, W.